Texans. We all know one thing, and that is there is no storm as tough as the people of Texas. We will rise again, and we will rebuild this great town and the affected areas across the entire state of Texas. But as we gather today here at this church, it's important that we remember that the greatest power that exists is the power of God. Amen. And the way that God can touch and move all of our lives.
Governor Greg Abbott outside the First Baptist Church in Rockport, Texas today. In addition to the Almighty, he praised those taking part in the rescue effort, which is, of course, still underway. He and Vice President Mike Pence also met with people displaced by the storm. We're going to talk about Texas Governor Abbott and his politics later in the show. First, the flooding in Texas and Louisiana poses major health and environmental risks to the region. Explosions were reported at a chemical plant just outside Houston, sending plumes of smoke into the air. And that's not to mention mosquitoes, mold, and the potential for contaminated drinking water. Joining us now is Emily Atkin. She covers science and environmental politics for The New Republic. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Robert Emery is here. He's Vice President for Safety at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with you. What are the immediate public health risks for people right now?
Well, the near term, I mean, the scientific data is quite clear that, you have many people who are displaced and they're very enthusiastic about wanting to get home and get their lives back to normal. And so the data shows the types of injuries that one might see would be things such as lifting up a bed that's been soaked underwater. You haven't lived until you've picked up a king-size bed that's full of water. Or carpet and these sorts of things. So those sorts of injuries, but then other sorts of things like carbon monoxide poisoning as people rely on portable generators, electrical problems. We won't see as many, thankfully, I don't think we'll see as many chainsaw injuries because it wasn't a high wind situation here. Improper mixing of chemicals for cleaning. The data is quite clear that there are certain things we need to anticipate. And the real challenge here is that if people get injured, the emergency rooms are already overloaded. This is why prevention is critically important. You don't want anybody getting hurt to the first place, but you get hurt, you're going to be standing in line.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, well, what about things like cholera, diseases like that come from contaminated water?
Well, you're going to see, so that near-term thing would be those injuries I just described, and then a little further down the road, there are going to be issues with standing water and people stepping on rusty nails I'm not an expert in that particular area, but surely mosquito-borne diseases are going to be huge. So things such as let's say Zika or whatever. So we're going to have to be attuned to that with regard to messaging to the public that as you return, number one, exercise caution. Number two, as the sun is actually out right now. It's actually quite refreshing, by the way. The sun is
funny. That's great.
First time I've seen the sun in a week. Get rid of that standing water do whatever work it is you're going to do, work within your boundaries. That's because I think that's been my experience. I've been in the wrong place at the right time enough to see where these people, they're doing the right thing. I mean, they're concerned, they're enthusiastic, they want to get back, they want their lives restored, but then sometimes they overdo it and then these events occur.
Okay, Emily, let's turn to you. This is home to, this area at least, Harris County, home to 24 Superfund sites, I understand, the oil and chemical industries. What kinds of environmental hazards are Houstonians facing?
Yeah, this is a truly unique situation in terms of hurricanes. Hurricanes are awful and pose public health risks whenever they hit anywhere. But with Houston, you have the heart of America's and possibly the world's petrochemical industry. And when floodwaters hit plants and also Superfund sites, you have an even greater environmental and public health risk than you did before. What I'm hearing is the biggest concern in terms of those refineries and petrochemical plants. Obviously, we're hearing a lot about that explosion that's happening in that one chemical plant, that Arkema chemical plant in Crosby. That is definitely an environmental hazard as well as a public health risk. But the bigger public health risk is the fact that The flooding has caused a lot of these refineries and petrochemical plants to shut down all at the same time. And when that happens, shutdowns are major emissions events. Plants release far more carcinogenic chemicals into the atmosphere than they do on a regular basis. If you look at the emissions reports on the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality website, you see far more abnormal emissions events than you would normally. During the storm, that was when they were shutting down during the storm, that was less of a public health risk than it could have been because of the rain and the wind and the clouds. Now that the rain is going away and the sunlight is coming out and the clouds are going away, the plants are all restarting at around the same time, and you'll see huge emissions events. And those will impact the communities that live exceedingly close to these plants, which in Houston, there are a lot because of their lack of zoning regulation.
Right. So you can build a house right next to a plant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I was looking at this because I visited those communities in 2014 and I was stunned by how close they were allowed to build their houses. I talked to one woman who literally her house was sandwiched between two simmering tanks of molasses. It's crazy.
Wow. So that's pollution in the air largely you're talking about. What about the water?
The water obviously is a problem, especially in sites, in places that are going to be close to Superfund sites, which have the potential to overflow with flooding. Unfortunately, we don't know much about whether Superfund sites have overflowed and whether the chemicals, Superfund sites, if your listeners don't know, you know, they're big hazardous industrial waste sites that have been designated by the federal government for cleanup.
And they have chemicals like lead and arsenic and benzene
in
them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And other weird stuff that you've never heard of that have awful effects, you know, because it's, you know, paper mills. That's one of the huge Superfund sites around the Houston area is just, you know.
Paper mills. You're breaking up, unfortunately, on your cell phone. So I'm going to turn to Robert for another question, and hopefully you can get closer to a good signal. Robert, let's talk about the drinking water. What kind of risks should residents there be worried about? Should they be boiling their water?
Well, we don't. Within the city of Houston, we've not received. I know they're actively monitoring. You know, the city of Houston water folks are monitoring that, and there's not been any boil water restrictions. From what I understand, I've been pretty busy today dealing with other stuff, but I understand, I think Beaumont, Texas, has lost their ability to pump water, and so I wouldn't be surprised if they don't get to a situation where they'll put in preventive boil water restrictions as well, and of course be trucking in bottled water and that sort of stuff. But at least where I'm at in the Texas Medical Center, we have not had that situation.
When do you think we'll get a full picture of the health risks?
Well, this is an orders of magnitude disaster that I think no one's ever experienced before, and I've been kind of busy, kind of focused on my things here with the university, but I was just at the George R. Brown Convention Center this morning, which is one of the major reception centers. I think they've capped out at 9,500 folks there, and that's since been overflowed, and there are many other reception centers as well, so it's going to take a little bit, but it's a big, big event. And but you know, the Texans are resilient. They're certainly going to need help and resources. But I'm not sure everybody who's been in the trenches has fully comprehended it yet.
And Emily, quickly, how long do you think we'll know it'll take before we know how many pollutants have been released because of this event?
If you can hear me all right,
I can hear you.
May never actually know how many were released. It's up to the companies to report their emissions. Air quality monitors in the Houston area are off. They were removed. They were taken offline because of flooding. So we'll see emissions reports from these facilities. They will be estimates. We may not know. As for water, it's the same. It's up to companies to report their emissions, and EPA will have a lot of monitoring to do, so it's going to be a little while.
Emily Atkin covers science and environmental politics for The New Republic. Robert Emery, Vice President for Safety at the University of Texas Health Science Center. Thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, the recovery is going to take a long time, years. It's already underway. FEMA says it's registered tens of thousands of people already, and some federal assistance is already being processed. But most of the people in the Houston area do not have flood insurance. In fact, an Associated Press investigation found that around 25,000 fewer properties have flood insurance compared with last year. Ken Sweet is a business writer with the AP. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So you reviewed data from FEMA, and it showed that lots of homeowners in Harris County dropped their insurance policies, their flood insurance policies. Why did they do that?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, so in Harris County, which is where Houston's located, we saw a 9% drop in the number of people holding flood insurance policies. That's a little bit less than the 10% nationwide drop. But it seems to be like the anecdote we keep hearing was kind of twofold. One, Tropical Storms Allison, which happened in 2001, was supposed to be a once-in-500-year event. So people went, oh, well, we got the big event. We're in the clear. Two, flood insurance is expensive. It's several hundred dollars, and it's often a pocketbook decision. Unless you live in a federally designated flood zone where you're required to have flood insurance if you have a mortgage, then it's something that a lot of people go without, and this is what we have now.
And this is not a federally designated flood zone?
Well, so there's basically kind of three or two categories of this. If you're in a 100-year flood zone, you're required to have flood insurance if you have a mortgage that's backed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the VA, which is the vast majority of the housing market. But if you don't have a mortgage, so you've paid off your home, or you live in a 500-year flood zone, then you're not required to have flood insurance, and you just kind of take on that risk.
And that's mainly what the Houston area is, a 500-year flood zone?
Yes.
Okay. Well, now we see that flooding is more common, though. So is it possible that the government will change its requirements and require more flood insurance?
Well, that's a really good question. So the National Flood Insurance Program is coming up for reauthorization at the end of next month, and that's going to require, you know, probably increasing the amount of debt that the program can take on, and also kind of the structure of it. And there's some very basic questions being asked about how this program operates. It's been criticized, particularly after Hurricane Sandy in 2012, where it took, you know, years for some homeowners in the New Jersey, New York area to get paid out from the insurance companies. And there's apparently like another 1,000 homeowners in that area who are still fighting, you know, 5 years later to get the money that they believe they deserve.
Mm. Well, so what is the process now? If you don't have insurance and you need to repair your home, what do you do?
You are in a very difficult situation, unfortunately. The first thing you should do if you have flood insurance or don't have flood insurance is you should register with FEMA, and you should be taking photos of all the damage that has happened in your home. If you have flood insurance, you contact your flood insurance company and you go through the process of that. The NFIP director, Roy Wright, has said that he's trying to get the first $10,000 of these policies paid out as quickly as possible so people can get back to building. But if you don't have flood insurance, you're going to be pulling from your savings to repair. You might be taking on low-interest loans. So the way that disaster loans happen in the United States is they're done through the Small Business Administration. Those are low-interest loans, but they have to be repaid. And unfortunately, I think we're going to be dealing with a lot of cases of people who have so much damage and they don't want to take on the debt that are going to just walk away from their home.
So there is the possibility that you'll just see lots of abandoned properties after the water dries up?
I think so.
Wow. Where will they go?
I mean, we had some of these stories during Hurricane Katrina. Actually, I mean, the sad story is that there's a very large population of former New Orleans who moved to Houston after Katrina because they could not rebuild, and now they live in a city that is going through the same tragedy that New Orleans went through.
And we saw New Orleans shrink precipitously in terms of population. Many fewer people live there now than lived there before Katrina. Could that happen to Houston?
That's a good question. I think Houston's economy is more dynamic than New Orleans is, which is mostly based on like tourism. As your previous segment talked about, there's a large petrochemical economy there. There's banks that are based there. So Houston has this much larger economy that probably will allow the area to rebound. But you know, you're still dealing with tens of billions of dollars worth of damage to a lot of people's homes, and people are probably going to be reviewing their options on whether they want to stay or not.
Yeah. So had they had flood insurance, would that make it more likely that they would stay and rebuild?
That's the hope. But, you know, the thing is that the problem here is that often, you know, the National Flood Insurance Program has been criticized for, there was a famous report that came out in 1998 about how people who lived in these, like, specially designated flood zones were getting flooded repeatedly, and we were paying out, and this is from the taxpayers, we were paying out more money to these homeowners than the home was actually worth. I think the story that came out was that there was one home that was flooded 33 times in 32 years, and we paid out like 8 times the amount that the house is actually worth. So we're going to pay these people out, and we're going to take on a lot more debt as taxpayers, and that's the agreement that we've made as a country.
Ken Sweet, business writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, California is considering letting low-level sex offenders off the lifetime registry. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Every state in America and the federal government has a registry for people who commit sex crimes. California was the first state to create one. And it's still one of only 4 states that puts people convicted of sex crimes on the registry for life, with no chance of having their names removed even when they've completed their sentences. A new bill would change that. It passed the state Senate and is now awaiting action in the Assembly. Like most other states, it would create a tiered system that allows some nonviolent offenders to be removed from the list over time. Victims' rights groups are against it, but a number of civil liberties and law enforcement groups support it, including the California Police Chiefs Association and the Association of Deputy District Attorneys. LA's District Attorney Jackie Lacey has been a big proponent. She recently spoke with KCRW about it.
It takes a lot of courage to say we've got too many people registered. Some of these people shouldn't. And because of that fear, we have allowed our system to become paralyzed and ineffective because there are simply too many people in there for law enforcement to keep track of. So this bill doesn't jeopardize public safety. It also declutters our registry so that we can keep track of those people that we should.
Okay, we're going to talk about this now with Janice Bellucci. She's an attorney and executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. That's a nonprofit which advocates for the legal rights of sex offenders. Welcome.
Thank you.
Who would be affected if this bill passes?
Well, in the biggest picture, actually everybody in the state of California would be affected because the public safety would increase. And what I mean by that is we would have a more efficient use of limited government resources in that whether you're law enforcement or you're a deputy DA, the fact is that you wouldn't have to spend as much money, as many resources monitoring people who do not pose a current danger.
Now, who are those people? What kinds of offenses have they been convicted of?
Well, we have people on our registry today who have done such things as a 16-year-old girl who took nude selfies and sent her nude selfies to boys in her high school, and she was convicted for creating and distributing child pornography. We have another high school boy who went streaking across his high school campus after graduation, and in offenses like that, sexting between teens and the like.
So teens can be on the registry for life?
Yes.
For that minor an offense?
Yes. In fact, one thing a lot of people don't realize is you can have a 14-year-old who looks at a photo of another nude 14-year-old on the internet. That person has just possessed child pornography and could face up to 5 years in prison, in federal prison, for viewing even one image.
Wow. Well, there are more than 100,000 people on the registry here in California. How many of them fit that bill? Those examples seem to be outrageous. How many of them are representative?
Well, according to statistics from the California Department of Justice, it's between 20 and 25% of the people on the registry today who have been convicted of misdemeanor offenses like the ones that I've just described. And they would, in fact, be able to petition for removal from the registry. None of this is automatic, but they could petition for removal.
Okay. And what does this bill say? That you have to be on it for a certain amount of years and then you can petition for removal?
Yes, it would create three tiers, which are similar to most states in our country. The first tier would be for those low-level offenders, including people who've been convicted of misdemeanor offenses only. The second tier would, in fact, include people who've been convicted of more serious offenses, and that would be for 20 years. The first tier, if I didn't say it, is for 10 years. The second tier is 20 years of registration. And the third year still would require lifetime registration, and those would certainly include people who've been convicted of violent offenses such as rape.
And who is in the second tier? What have they done?
Second tier at this point could be distribution of child pornography. And unfortunately, that's easier to do than most people realize. And what I mean by that, not everybody, but many people who look at child pornography, again, which could be a photo of a naked teenager, we're not talking about sexual acts even, if they keep their computer open to some of these websites where somebody can actually send something to you, even if you haven't requested it, just because you've opened up your computer to that, you could, in fact, be found guilty of distributing child pornography. So that would, in fact, be a Tier 2 offense.
Now, as I said in the introduction, victims groups are against this bill. They say people guilty of so-called lewd and lascivious acts with a minor or sex with a minor or rape, they should pay for that crime, and that people in their communities have a right to know what they've done.
Well, I can understand that feeling, and I also believe that they don't know the total picture. So perhaps they don't understand that everybody who's on the sex offender registry has already paid their debt to society. And so what I mean by that, they've already been to prison, they've already been to jail, depending upon their sentence. Some of them might be on parole or probation currently being monitored by local law enforcement. But the fact is, we have people on our registry who've been there more than 50 years, and I do mean 50.
But do you think that that should apply to everyone, even the so-called third tier, the ones that have committed the worst acts?
I'm not sure of your question there, Madeline, but...
Well, the question being, should they be on there for life, or do you think they too, even the most severe cases, should be allowed to get off the list eventually?
Well, what the bill would do was keep people like that. And Phil Garrido is somebody that folks might remember. Phil Garrido captured J.C. Dugard. He kidnapped her from school, and he held her captive for 18 years. The chance of Phil Garrido actually being released from prison is small, but if he were to be released, he certainly would be in Tier 3, and the bill would require him to register for the rest of his life.
I guess I'm asking if you support that part of the bill. Do you think that that's fair?
I don't think it's supported by empirical evidence, but I believe that's what is politically feasible to do today.
But why do you not support that? Why it sounds like you think that they should not be on the list after they've paid their debt to society in terms of a prison sentence.
You know, it's a matter of time how long people should be monitored. And there is an expert. I'm an attorney. I'm not a researcher. But there is a very well-known international expert on this topic of reoffense. His name is Dr. Carl Hansen. And what Dr. Hansen has found out after decades of research is that people who have been convicted of different levels of offenses, what their likelihood of reoffense is. And so according to his findings, and again, after decades of research, he has found that even a person who's been convicted of violent rape, after he's been in the community for 17 years, and that is 17 years in the community, not 17 years in prison, if he has not reoffended after that 17-year period, he's unlikely to reoffend.
So what is the next step for this bill? I understand it has passed the state Senate. What's next, and what's its likelihood of passage into law and Governor Brown signing it?
Well, my crystal ball is a little fuzzy today as far as likelihood of passage, but I can tell you what the next two steps are. One is that actually it's tomorrow that this bill will be in front of the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly, and that committee has an important decision to make. It's put the bill and many other bills in something called a suspense file, and tomorrow the committee will announce its decision whether or not to remove that bill from the suspense file. And if the bill is removed from the suspense file, then it will go forward to the Assembly floor, and that will happen sometime between September 5th and September 15th. If the bill is not released from the suspense file, it will die.
But what's your sense in terms of speaking to lawmakers or hearing what's happening in Sacramento about whether this will pass or not? What do you think?
I'm cautiously optimistic that the Appropriations Committee will release the bill and it will go to the Assembly floor. I'm not so optimistic about the Assembly floor itself.
So people are very passionate about this topic, and they just, you know, there's an ick factor involved, and it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. I think most people probably support some kind of a registry. And yet people who are on it have been shunned. And as you say, in terms of their legal debt, they have paid it to society after they've gone to prison and been released. So how do you counter that feeling out there in society that this is the most heinous of crimes and people who commit them are different and need to be treated accordingly?
Well, my request of everybody in our society is that they think with their head and they stop acting based upon emotion and misinformation. So if people will actually look at the empirical evidence, I mentioned Dr. Carl Hansen, for example, but we have another expert in Florida, Dr. Jill Levinson, and many others who have actually done the research about what is the current danger that anybody on the sex offender registry poses. There are tools out there that can determine their level of risk. And some people, they still pose a high risk. Those people actually need to go to counseling, and most of them do go to counseling, and most of them do work on rehabilitation. Some of them, by the way, the people on the registry have drug and alcohol problems, and they need to be cured of those drug and alcohol problems, too, so that they can, in fact, control their behavior. But the fact is that if anybody looks at this vast amount of empirical evidence, they will understand that the risk level for people on the registry, especially in California, which has a lifetime registry for all, varies widely. And unfortunately today, without this bill, everybody on the registry is being treated the same. It's not a good use of government resources. It doesn't increase public safety. In fact, it decreases public safety. And that's not my conclusion, but it's the conclusion of the California Sex Offender Management Board. And that board was created by the state legislature to speak on topics like this. And what they've noticed is that many people who are on the registry become homeless. And once they become homeless, then they're less stable. And society, their danger to society increases. So what the board has, in fact, supports, by the way, they support the tiered registry bill as well, is that there be fewer people on the registry who are homeless, more people who are stable, and therefore the public safety will increase.
All right. We'll have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Janice Bellucci. She's an attorney and executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. Coming up, Texas Governor Greg Abbott in the spotlight during Harvey. We'll talk about his rise in conservative politics.
It's the power of God that was able to pull people out of the water and literally save them.
We'll have that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We are seeing and hearing a lot of Texas Governor Greg Abbott this week. Here he is with Vice President Mike Pence at a church today.
It was God acting through the lives of so many Texans who came to the rescue of other Texans. It's the power of God that was able to pull people out of the water and literally save them. And as a result of that, I think it's very important that I issue and sign a Texas gubernatorial proclamation here today. By the power vested in me as governor of the state of Texas, I am declaring this Sunday, September 3rd, as a day of prayer in Texas.
He's been governor for 3 years. Greg Abbott was attorney general before that. To call him a staunch conservative is an understatement. He has staked out far-right positions on business issues, social issues, pretty much every issue you can think of. Patrick Svitek is a political reporter with the Texas Tribune. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Okay, so for those of us who don't know much about him, help us out here. The first thing we may notice when we watch him on TV is that he's in a wheelchair. What happened?
Yeah, that's the result of a kind of freak accident a long time ago. I think a number of decades ago, he was jogging or going for a jog outside his home in Houston during a storm was coming in, and a tree cracked and fell on him. And ever since then, he's used a wheelchair. He's been paralyzed from the waist down. And so that is something that, you know, definitely strikes people when they first see him, whether they're here in Texas, whether they're seeing him on TV from outside the state.
Right. How popular is he as governor?
You know, right now he's actually one of the most, if not the most popular Republican politicians in Texas. You know, we have several statewide officials here, and we have several legislative leaders here. And in most public opinion polling that you see, he is by far the most popular of them.
Oh, and is it because of his conservative credentials? Is that why?
You know, I think that's a part of it. You know, the state of Texas actually, you know, over the past several years in terms of the policy debates and where the political environment is headed, has actually become more conservative, I think, than most people realize. And I think he's had some success over those past several years in kind of, you know, staying a pace with the Republican Party in Texas as it becomes more conservative. You know, he is very conservative on paper, but still tries to kind of straddle the divide between the more moderate Republicans in the party in Texas and some of the very, very conservative Republicans. So I think that probably contributes to his popularity.
Yeah, and he was attorney general before he was governor, and he made a name for himself, I understand, suing the Obama administration. What did he sue the administration for?
Yeah, so he ended up suing the Obama administration or the federal government during that period over 30 times.
30?
There were a number of,
30?
Yeah. There were a number of notable cases. I think the one that got him the most attention outside of Texas was his defense, or at least the state's defense, of a Ten Commandments monument on state Capitol grounds. It was a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court in the state of Texas, won in defending their right to have that on Capitol grounds. That's one that got him a lot of attention. It was a period during which the Solicitor General was Ted Cruz, who's now obviously a very well-known U.S. senator from Texas.
Hmm. What was his role in the Whole Woman's Health case that went to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, this was an abortion case that went to the Supreme Court, and that he was, very on the front lines of defending. And I mean, he has been, whether it's as Attorney General or as Governor, a leading figure in both proposing and pushing various anti-abortion policies in Texas, and then when they reach the courts, defending them.
In fact, there is a law that he signed that goes into effect tomorrow. A very strict law. Can you tell us briefly what's in it?
Yeah, there are a number of state laws that go into effect tomorrow, not just and a number of them are also anti-abortion laws or laws that deal with abortion. The one I think you're maybe talking about is a Senate Bill 258, which is a bill that mandates that doctors take extra measures when dealing with fetal remains, including requiring doctors to bury or cremate fetal remains from abortions and miscarriages. But that's just, one of several laws going into effect that deal with abortion, and not the only one that's already under legal scrutiny.
Hmm. And then also there was this decision yesterday, a federal judge striking down the sanctuary law in Texas. What was his role in that?
Yeah, this is actually, you know, he's been in office as governor for almost 3 years now, or 2.5 years, and this has probably been his biggest legislative push and subsequent achievement. He started this past legislative session asking lawmakers to send a bill to his desk that would ban what a lot of Republicans here describe as sanctuary cities. These are places where the people who are pushing these laws believe that local government officials are not fully cooperating with federal immigration authorities. And so that law was passed during the most recent legislative session. Opponents of it very quickly sued and tried to get it stopped. And yesterday there was a decision in a federal district judge, ruled against the state of Texas and halted major provisions of this law just days, as you pointed out, before it was scheduled to go into effect.
Yeah, I think we have a clip of tape of him talking about this.
If a sheriff refuses to enforce the laws of the United States of America, they need to quit their job. If they don't want to enforce the law, they should not be in law enforcement.
So there he is, definitely mirroring the Trump administration and its philosophy about sanctuary cities. How close is he to the Trump administration?
You know, I'd say he's pretty close just by virtue of the fact that a lot of the policies that he and other Republican leaders in Texas have been pushing dovetail, pretty well with what the administration is pushing. This sanctuary cities law was something that he prioritized long before Donald Trump was in the White House. Months before the legislative session began in January, he was pushing for it. But it ended up, as you pointed out, kind of coinciding with a very similar push at the federal level. And so I think that he's gained a lot of, contacts in the White House and built something of a relationship with the president just based on their shared policy goals.
How do you think that Harvey will change his view of the role of government? He and Texas, notoriously anti-regulation, anti-government intervention. Do you think that this disaster will change his stance?
You know, I don't know how much it will fundamentally change his stance about the role of government, but it will definitely put to test, the belief by a lot of Republicans in power in Texas that, the best way of life is for the government to play as small of a role as possible. Obviously, a natural disaster of this scale will certainly test that. And it will also test the relationship between state officials and local officials here in Texas, which has been frayed. There was just a special legislative session here where there were a number of policies that were proposed, not many of them ultimately made to the finish line, but they were very offensive to local officials. They believed that they were aimed at peeling away their authority because, again, here in Texas, it's largely a Republican state, but we have a number of major urban centers that are controlled by Democrats, and so there's always this natural tension between the state government and the local government. So I think that will be a key test as well.
Yeah, including Houston. Patrick Svitek, political reporter with the Texas Tribune. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, Google yourself and you'll see how much information is online. But what if it's wrong? Who's responsible for fixing it? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Google yourself and a bunch of people search websites pop up. Click on them and you'll likely see your age, your phone number, the names of your relatives, the places you've lived, maybe even court records, criminal records, things that might be a little embarrassing. Well, a Virginia man is suing one of those sites, Spokio, and his case is a test of whether people like you and me have standing to sue companies like Spokio if the information they post is not accurate. And here to tell us more is LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. And as it turns out, one of David's columns is mentioned in the lawsuit. Hi, David.
Hiya, Madeline.
The Virginia man suing, his name is Thomas Robbins. And what is his case? What is he suing for?
Well, what he's suing for is basically he's alleging that there was erroneous information about him on Spokio, which is a Pasadena-based people search service. Well, the last 6 years, they've been wrangling over his standing. In other words, has he received genuine harm from this or not? It went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now it's been given the go-ahead by an appellate court going back to the district court. And the bottom line is he and possibly many others, if it gets class action status, will now be able to file a lawsuit essentially saying that these people search services have a responsibility to make sure that the information they have about us, which none of us give them permission to do, that the information is correct as per federal law, because the credit reporting agencies, Experian, Equifax, they are required by law to make a good faith effort to make sure that their info is legit. Whereas if you look at the terms of service for Spokio, it says we don't make any such guarantees about our information. In other words, it could be garbage, and it's about us.
So what do they say exactly, Spokio, as their defense? That they don't actually collect that information? They're just publishing it? They're just a middleman?
Well, kind of, sort of. These guys are basically saying, look, we're taking publicly available information, whether it's court records, social media posts, any such thing, things that in the past were very, very hard for people to get. I mean, you'd have to go to every courthouse in the country to amass court records. Well, these guys turn it all into low-hanging fruit, and you know, it essentially becomes a stalker's best friend as a result of that. But their argument is, look, we don't have to pay attention to making sure that the information is any good, because we're not a credit reporting agency. We're going to say on our website repeatedly that we're not a credit reporting agency, and therefore the federal Fair Credit Reporting Act doesn't apply to us. I talked to some lawyers, and they said, I don't know about that, because the bottom line is, if they're making this information available to potential employers, which they are, or potential lenders, which they are, that in turn might fall under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and in, as this lawsuit is alleging, in turn can have repercussions for people. In the case of the plaintiff, in this case, Mr. Robbins, he's alleging that he was unemployed at the time. There was a bunch of bogus info about him on Spokio, and he says he was harmed because he probably was denied job opportunities as a result of that. Don't know whether that was indeed the case, but I think he makes a very valid point that if these guys are going to put up information about us, they kind of got some responsibility to make sure that it's good info.
Now, is the argument that they need to get it right, or is the argument that they shouldn't be publishing this at all?
The argument is that they need to get it right, because let's emphasize, this is primarily publicly available information. But again, there is a federal law out there that says certain types of information purveyors, in other words, credit reporting agencies, have a responsibility to make sure, as best they can, reasonable efforts, that the information they're hawking is okay. And the thing about these people search services, and there's dozens of them out there, is that none of us give them permission to aggregate our information. None of us give them permission to profit from our information. So it doesn't seem unreasonable for us to at least turn to them and say, well, look, if you're going to do all that, at least get it right.
Is there a way, though, to get yourself off these lists?
There is. You can opt out. And in fact, Spokio has an opt-out function. But I went through that process myself and found it to be a little too cumbersome, a little confusing. And since the column ran, I've heard from a number of people who tried to opt out from Spokio and also found their information hard to get off the site. And you know what's really telling here, Madeline, is I spoke some years ago with the founder of Spokio, a guy named Harrison Tang, and asked him, well, is your information on your site? He said, oh, no, I opted out. I said, what, you opted out of your own website? He said, oh, yeah, I was getting death threats. and that kind of tells the whole thing. If the founder of this people search company doesn't want his information out there, why should any of us have to put up with it?
Well, what does he say is the purpose of this? Why does he think he's performing some kind of public service?
Nah, he's making some money, but, yeah. You know, he's going to tell you that he's not doing anything wrong, and technically he's not, as long as he's in the public information game. And make no mistake, Spokio isn't alone in this. There's a lot of guys who now do this. But I really want to emphasize, a lot of our public information, court records, DMV records, voter information, all that stuff, it was all deliberately hard to get at, shielded behind bureaucracies, requiring, you know, actual, like, reporters who would have to go out to a courthouse and look at it. Now that it can all be aggregated and searched for online, it's become a little too easy to get. And I think lawmakers might want to step up and look at that. And I've proposed in my column a do not aggregate list, similar to the do not call list.
That sounds like a great thing, do not aggregate list.
It is a great thing. We'll call this the Lazarus idea.
So why don't lawmakers get on that? Because it would seem that most of their constituents would want that.
You would think, although, let's face it, with a Republican administration in power and Republicans in power in Congress, anything that steps on the toes of private business is not going to be seen as a good thing. But in this case, it kind of makes sense, because what I think is the solution to this is people would go to the Fair Trade Commission. They would say, I want to be on the do not aggregate list. And then if a people search company that is selling the info, in other words, it's commercial in nature, and doesn't uphold the Fair Credit Reporting Act, well, if they're aggregating the info, then they'd be in violation of the list. It seems like a reasonable thing. But then again, every time I propose reasonable things, they, you know, what are you going to do?
Okay. David Lazarus, the eminently reasonable consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Madeline.
Let's go. Batter up. We're taking the afternoon off. It's a beautiful day for a ball game.
Okay, a beautiful day here in LA because every day is beautiful here in LA. But not a beautiful night last night for the Dodgers because they lost again. Mario Saavedra, what is happening?
Yeah, another loss. They lost 6-4 to the D-backs. Cody Bellinger, who
that's
was
the Diamondbacks for those of us not in the know.
Yeah, Diamondbacks. There you go. Yeah, Cody Bellinger, who was so hot earlier in the year, he came back from the disabled list last night, but that wasn't enough.
Well, so why wasn't it enough? And should they trade him now?
No. Do not say that word. Trade him, Cody Bellinger. How dare you, Madeline?
Sorry.
You know, we'll let that one go.
Little patience for these losses. Okay. But I guess we should have patience, right?
Definitely. No, of course.
Right.
Of course. It's only four games, and they have a chance to come back and win. So go Dodgers.
Ever optimistic. Mario Saavedra, thank you. All right, Christian Bordahl, here to round out the show.
Yes, hi, Madeline. So we talked earlier about the really difficult topic of changing the rules of the state's sex offender registry.
Yeah.
The rules now say that you're on for life. There's a new law passed the state Senate, up for consideration in the Assembly, says it would be possible for low-level offenders to petition to get their names off the list. We asked listeners for their thoughts about that. Laurel Lee James says that's a bad idea. Arturo Reyna says a sex offender is a sex offender. They just got caught this time, maybe with something nonviolent. But Carl Wiggins points out an 18-year-old dating a 17-year-old reported by parents is still considered a sex offender. Glenn Habus says we shouldn't paint all offenders with the same broad brush. Low-level offenders who made mistakes 30 years ago shouldn't have to carry this scarlet letter for the rest of their lives. So a lot of different thoughts about this, and certainly passions run high sometimes when you talk about sex offenses.
And then some of the things that she mentioned in our interview were pretty surprising. That 16-year-old girl who posted a naked selfie is on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, okay. All right, Christian Bordahl, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.